The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, I'm going to be addressing the question of the danger of cell phones and other electromagnetic appliances. I'll be doing a newsmaker interview with Dr. Devra Davis. She is a well-respected environmental health expert and founder of the Environmental Health Trust in Washington, D.C. She's a professor of epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, where she headed the world's first center on environmental oncology. She's now a visiting professor at Harvard and Georgetown Universities. We'll be exploring why it took 15 years for the American public to recognize something that we were telling you about 15 years ago. And all since then, and only now, are we finding out that we virtually will have, unquestionably, an epidemic of brain cancer, jaw cancer, ear cancer in the near future. Then, commentaries from Professor Paul Craig Roberts, The Decline and Fall of the American Empire from Global Research, and why I believe that this entire debate over capping or limiting budget increases on the national debt was a complete facade. It was a fraud. I'll cite today absolute irrefutable proof that the President of the United States, based upon Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, had everything necessary in order to go right forward and not create this ploy. Also, commentary today from Keith Overman. I have a lot of respect when he really lets loose, and he did, and you will hear it. And this is rare for him. He let loose a lot and did outstanding commentaries against George Bush's programs, but he hasn't been as strong, but today he is. And then another look at having you understand the difference between the national debt and the national budget. What we spend versus what we owe. Who do we owe this money to? I'll get to that. Also, commentaries coming up. Teenagers, God's Answer to Psychological Oppression by Dr. Stuart Janine Bramhall, a brilliant understanding of what is happening with the youth around the world today that is challenging regimes everywhere. From Sarah Jaffe from Alternet, how recession is hastening the Walmart mindset of America. Also, time permitting, from David Harris Gershon from Tycom, hundreds of thousands of protesters take to the streets in Israel. Did you see it anywhere in the American media? Where? Which broadcast? This was one of the most perfect isolations of a story, and yet, as a percentage of the population, as many people went to the streets to protest in Israel about social change. Why didn't we cover that? And other commentaries coming at you. Let's begin, always with something positive and constructive in how we can better heal. This is from Judith Stock, and it says, reconnecting children and nature. It may not be recognized by the AMA, but nature deficit disorder is raising Cain with children in the industrialized world, and it can be fought. Of course, there is no such thing as nature deficit disorder, but the American Psychiatric Association would like to create titles that then allow people to be pathologized and then they can be treated. Well, everyone needs to be in nature. That's without question. Traditionally, nature served as humanity's greatest teacher, the place where artists, poets, scientists go for inspiration. The natural world has the ability to draw us in and allow us to experience a sense of wonder. But what happens when children fail to bond with nature? Nature deficit disorder isn't a medical term, but a social phenomena. And natural deficit disorder describes the high cost of separation between nature and children. including attention deficit disorder, childhood obesity, high rates of physical and emotional illness, and the list goes on. Quote, there is very little that children do in their lives that compares with their first experiences in nature. Now, think back to your own childhood experiences of being outside on a quest to discover your surroundings. Today, instead of hiking and swimming and telling stories around campfires, children are more likely to attend computer or weight loss class or play video games indoors. These activities relegate nature to a non-reality for children. In this particular study, the author cites an eye-opening 1991 study of three generations of nine-year-olds, and it, quote, found between 1970 and 1990, the radius around the home where children were allowed to roam on their own had shrunk by 90% of what it had been in 1970. In effect, we were so fearful of our children experiencing anything outside of parental control that we simply only allowed them to experience what we could control. And as a result, this made a difference. As the author explains, as a child, he had spent time in nature and felt that he'd gained something important. Then, in the late 1980s, while interviewing people for a book he was writing about the changing realities of family life, he recognized there was a profound change in the way that people viewed nature. Yet no one had a way to describe that condition. Here are some of the activities that encourage the connection with nature. If you can't come to one of the natural parks, join the Web Rangers program, where kids can play interactive games, build a ranger station, and other activities. Enroll the family in nature clubs around the country that provide opportunity for families to get outside in the natural world, and Children Nature Network resources and activities. So I would agree with this. I agree it doesn't create a real condition of mental deprivation. It merely limits a child or an adult's ability to connect with what is real, to take your shoes off and feel your feet on the ground, to smell nature without the hustle and bustle that goes on. The other day I was walking down Amsterdam Avenue, and there's a very popular area where there are dozens of restaurants, from 84th in Amsterdam to about 79th in Amsterdam. And I noticed how dirty everything was, how much garbage was piled up on the street in bags. The restaurants were all packed outside. It was noisy. It was hot and sticky. And yet, people seemed oblivious to this. Now, I've been filming in nature recently, and what a difference when you see nature for what it is. We're just not getting out to nature, and we pay a price for it. Separately, we're overprotecting our children, not allowing children to have any defined experiences that they can contribute to their own understanding of life. They're taught everything. They're told everything. They're given too much information, and they're expressly told that this is the information you need to succeed and survive in life. So a child's own sense of wonderment, their own sense of analyzing the world they live in, that seems to be passé. Little story, back in the 1970s, every weekend of the summer, I would invite church groups who had inner city children to visit my farm upstate. And every week, hundreds of kids would come up on a Saturday, and they would spend the day seeing how a cow is milked and cheese made, how vegetables are grown, and how food is prepared. They had a chance to play with goats and sheep and little ponies. They had a chance to take a nature walk and see an eagle's nest and a family of deer that would actually come up and eat out of your hands. They had a chance to look at beavers swimming and building their dams. That was a very important experience for them, especially when you consider what they were going to face the rest of the day, the rest of the week, the hardness of a city, and what lessons that were so important to them were not given. I remember once I was at my ranch down in Texas, And I just finished broadcasting my radio show, and I was sitting out on a porch on a lake, and my brother came over, Howard, and he said, there's a woman out here in a bus and with some kids wanting to know if she could speak with you. I said, sure. So I went over to the road, and there was this woman in a small bus. It was like a van, and it had, like, I'm guessing around 8 to 10 kids in it, and they all had their faces pressed up against the window looking out, because there was a whole herd of buffalo on one side of the bus and long-haired Scottish Highlander cattle on the other side. And my brother was out there petting and feeding the buffalo, which he liked to do. And she said, we heard that you had some unusual animals. Would it be all right if you showed them to us? And I said, sure. So we got the kids out. And then I didn't realize till she opened the door, they were all children with physical limitations. They were all in wheelchairs. So now we got them all out. And I went in, I made up a big batch of, I think it was lemonade. And I said, well, have you ever been around a lemur? No. So I went over and I opened up the big enclosure, and I brought out some lemurs, and I let them hold them, and they just had the time of their life, because these lemurs are very loving. I said, take a grape and feed it to the lemurs. So they were feeding the lemurs these grapes. Their smile went from ear to ear. And then I took them out, I showed them the other animals. And I had at that time as many hoofstock varieties as the Dallas Zoo, about 400. I had a good breeding program that they didn't even have success with. But again, I was feeding grasses, and I gave them lots of open room. Like two animals had 5 acres. That's a tremendous amount of space. And they got a lot of personal attention. All the creatures there got personal attention, lots of love. And, of course, they had the healing water they drank every day. Anyhow, the woman said, this was such a nice experience. I'm sure there are a few other teachers like to bring their students. I said, fine. What I didn't know was how many teachers, how many students. Oh, wow. I remember it was the local sheriff came over and says, well, we're going to have to spend some time helping out here, because otherwise it's going to be a log jam. And I said, log jam for what? This is about 2 weeks later. Well, you get about 25 vans out here filled with kids. Word got out, and every day it just came. So then I just hired someone. That's all they did, is take all these kids on a trip and teach about nature and farming and give them vegetables to take home with them. It was just a wonderful experience. And I'm going to do that again in the very near future. I'm finishing up on a major piece of property where I'm going to have a part of it where children can come and learn, and teenagers and others, those who don't have a chance to get near nature. I believe it's now time for all the baby boomers in this audience. You've lived your life the way you thought was important, and indeed in many areas it probably was. Now you have a chance to live your life all over again. All the crisis we're in, the changes that are occurring, give you a chance to start over. Why not start over and make nature and a balance with nature an important part of that? I'll bet a lot of you have been deprived of being in nature in the last 10, 20, 30 years. Finally up on this, going into a hospital is far riskier than flying. This is from the World Health Organization. Quote, millions of people die each year from medical errors and infections linked to health care, and going into hospital is far riskier than flying, the World Health Organization has stated this in Reuters. Quote, if you're admitted to a hospital tomorrow in any country, your chances of being subjected to an error in your care would be something like 1 in 10. Your chances of dying due to an error in health care are 1 in 300. Your chance of dying in an airplane crash are 1 in 10 million. Okay, so they're telling us our hospitals are dangerous. Now here's a question. What are they doing to lessen that? Every year, the numbers keep going up. Unnecessary procedures, unnecessary x-rays, unnecessary antibiotics, unnecessary screening. Nothing's being done about it. Finally, grape flavonoids show sun protection. This is good for this time of year. This is from the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. Researchers from the University of Barcelona and the Spanish National Research Council report the discovery of compounds in grapes that can protect the skin from ultraviolet radiation. And we know that excessive exposure to ultraviolet radiation is recognized as a leading cause of skin cancer and premature skin aging. And the team showed that those who took the greatest amount of the polyphenolic fractions that are found in grapes, meaning when you eat grapes or you drink grape juice or red wine, you're protecting your body. You're protecting from the ultraviolet radiation. So what can we do realistically? Well, if you took 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C, 1,000 milligrams of quercetin, and 200 milligrams of resveratrol, or grapeseed extract before going out in the sun, you've done an enormous amount of good to help protect yourself from damaged skin. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. All it takes is a little research to see that so much of what we've been going through lately was completely preventable. There has been some talk that the president can act unilaterally to raise the national debt limit based upon Section 4 of the 14th Amendment in the Constitution, which provides the pertinent part that the, quote, the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law shall not be questioned. Well, the argument has been made that since Congress has already authorized by law each obligation represented in the national debt, by approximating the funds for various expenditures, an overall debt limit is artificially redundant. And that's why even though it's been signed into law, there's a lesson for us to be learned, because we chose not to learn it beforehand. It'd be like writing a bunch of checks and then refusing to deposit the funds in your account to cover them. And while a constitutional challenge of the debt limit law may be a defensible argument in the spirit of the 14th Amendment, is not unequivocally compelling, as the 14th Amendment does not expressly authorize what proponents are asking the president to do. With this context, it is astonishing that apparently nobody has bothered to read the text of the public debt law of 1941 itself, embodied in 31 U.S.C. 3101. Which is what codifies a national debt limit. That law states, quote, the face amount of obligations issued under this chapter and the face amount of obligations whose principal and interest are guaranteed by the United States government, except guaranteed obligations held by the Secretary of the Treasury, may not be more than, and whatever that amount is. Now, please take note of the words, except guaranteed obligations held by the Secretary of the Treasury. By undeniably clear law, as passed by Congress, such obligations are not constrained by any so-called debt limit. Now, all of you have to do is run your finger down that very section to 31 U.S.C. 3102, and you will read, quote, with the approval of the President, the Secretary of the Treasury may borrow on the credit of the United States amounts necessary for expenditures authorized by law. But this section, Congress gives the President the express, inherent, and unilateral authority to direct the Secretary of the Treasury to incur obligations to cover all expenditures authorized by law, which is to say the sum of the appropriations bill Congress has already passed. And as we have just so clearly demonstrated, such obligations are immune from any so-called debt ceiling limitations. Surely there's some White House attorney smart enough to figure this all out, as you have just been given. The president must evoke this authority in such situations, but he chose not to. He chose to abrogate that. And because he's a constitutional scholar, he cannot get off the hook by saying he didn't know. Remember, the President of the United States has at his beck and call, immediately, 24/7, more than 20,000 attorneys working for the United States government in Washington alone. So, just understood that it was there all along, and there was a choice not to use it. Now for our issue of the day. Our guest will be here in about 20 minutes. It's a short newsmaker guest, but it's still important to know about cell phones. The United States government, and it's media colleagues have wasted time and energy creating hysteria over a non-existent debt ceiling crisis. After reading the news in the areas of propaganda, all I can say is gross stupidity on everyone involved. The rest of the world, they look at us and they're dumbfounded by the immaturity of what is considered by us as the only superpower. Really? What kind of superpower are we? The world is wondering that we are willing to go clear down as we did just a day ago to convince the world, which holds its banking reserves and U.S. Treasury debt, that the U.S. government will default on a debt. Every country in the world now worries about the judgment and sanity of the country with the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. This is the achievement of the Republicans, who took an ordinary, commonplace increase in the debt ceiling limit, an event that has occurred routinely many times over the course of my life, and turned it into a crisis threatening the world financial system. To be clear, there was never any risk whatsoever with U.S. default, as President Obama has power established by President George Bush, Presidential Directive 51, to declare default a national emergency and to set aside the debt ceiling limit and Congress's power of the purse, and to continue to issue the debt necessary to fund the government and its wars. That the American press ever took this highly hyped crisis seriously merely demonstrates their pathetic status. The U.S. public debt is rising too rapidly against U.S. gross domestic product, although it is still below the percentages during World War II. The problem that is ignored by the idiots, I have no better word I can express, in Washington and the prostitutes, is that the debt is rising relative to the economy because the economy is not rising. But war and their expenditures are. Why is our economy not rising? It's not rising because it has been offshored. What formerly was U.S. gross domestic product in Gary, Indiana, and St. Louis, and Detroit, and Silicon Valley, and other U.S. locations that I've been traveling to on a regular basis and filming for this new film I'm doing, is now gross domestic product for China, India, Indonesia, and other countries where manufacturing labor and professional services can be hired at pennies on the dollar. What happens with offshoring? The answer is clear. U.S. gross domestic product, consumer income, career opportunities, and tax base leave the country. Corporate profits and bonuses rise due to the lower labor cost. Well, who's this good for? The answer is that it is only good for Wall Street, corporate shareholders, and corporate management. Their incomes go up, the gross domestic product goes down, along with the employment opportunities of Americans and the tax base for government. The utter destroyer of American economic prospects was the deregulation of the financial sector. Economists, who have no standards, theorized that markets were self-regulating. They were wrong. All of them were wrong. And hence they created this massive illusion that greed was never a problem. This was the music and the dollars to Wall Street's ears. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan and the Wall Street-owned U.S. Treasury jumped on board. Those who, like Brooksley Bourne, were empowered by U.S. law to regulate derivatives were driven out of office by the Federal Reserve Chairman and the U.S. Treasury Secretary and the Securities and Exchange Chairman. Who were that little motley crew in Washington? Well, it was Lawrence Summers, Timothy Geithner, and Robert Rubin. Aren't those the same people that Obama had? Yeah, one and the same. So it's not really about Democrat and Republican? No. They're both the same. It was against the people's interest. Financial institutions freed from the Glass-Steagall Act, freed from capital requirements, and freed from oversight, immediately took debt leverage on highly unrealistic bets to amazing heights. When the schemes collapsed, the Federal Reserve lent U.S. and foreign banks $16.1 trillion, all in secret, a sum larger than U.S. national debt and larger than our, even our gross domestic product. Well, where did the Federal Reserve get $16.1 million to lend? Listen carefully, friends. The Federal Reserve, a completely criminal organization, created it out of thin air with a stroke of a computer entry. There was zero backing it up, nothing. And while the Federal Reserve created $16.1 trillion in new loans for private banks and bailed out banks bulldozed the foreclosed homes of the evicted Americans. So in America, the light unto the world, American citizens are thrown out of their homes, nor do the banks can bulldoze their homes, so they don't have to pay property taxes on the homes that are foreclosed on. Only in America does this make sense. And it's not only Americans who are being made homeless by U.S. policies. Afghans, Pakistanis, Iraqis, Yemenis, Somalis, Libyans are also consigned to homelessness by American policy. Moreover, America's wars against these peoples together with a supporting military security budget account for 75% of the U.S. budget deficit. Indeed, the cost of these wars exceed the planned future budget savings from the debt limit deal. In other words, the cost of the wars that make millions of foreign people homeless use up revenues that the federal government could have used to keep Americans in their homes and teachers in their schools. As much as many Republicans profess to be concerned about U.S. public debt, Republicans were not sufficiently concerned to address their issue by cutting back the $1.2 trillion military security budget or by raising the low tax rates on the mega-rich. Look at these July 30 headlines, just 2 days prior to the default deadline, from the online group Stop NATO. U.S. military to be based in Australia to confront China. Call to expand American counterinsurgency operations in the Philippines. U.S. could upgrade Polish warships for the Baltic Sea. Bulgaria, Pentagon continues upgrading military bases. U.S. uses Romanian air base to supply Afghan more. America's African partnership station in East Africa. Mongolia, U.S. leads NATO, Asian NATO allies in the military exercise. Libyan war, over 17,000 Libyan NATO air missions, nearly 6,500 air strikes. The big picture, war on Libya, is war on Africa. What in the world is a country facing bankruptcy and default doing conducting military exercises in Mongolia and Central Asia? What is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, designed to counter a Soviet thrust into Western Europe doing in Mongolia? Why are these military expenditures necessary, but not expenditures to keep America's homeless population from rising while homes are destroyed? Why do not the Republicans listen when mega-billionaire Warren Buffett says that the tax rate on his massive income is lower than the tax rate on his secretary's income? The answer is that the Republicans have an agenda. War. And Republicans want to fund this war, not by taxing high incomes, but by cutting support programs for the down and out. So what does this mean? Even if all the cuts actually happen, the weakening economy will result in new deficit projections that will wipe out the expected savings from the debt limit agreement. What then will the government do? Until U.S. policymakers comprehend that the economy has been moved offshore and take steps to bring it back home, there will be no solution to the unemployment or to the debt problem. I'm Gary Nall, Paul Craig Roberts. Now, for a final go here, a commentary by Keith Urban, after which you can please call in and share your points of view, as this is the issue part of our program where we open it up for you. 888-874-4888.
I close as promised with a special comment on the debt deal. Our government has now given up the concept of right and wrong. We have in this deal declared that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all political incumbents are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are renomination, re-election, and the pursuit of hypocrisy. We have in this deal gone from the four freedoms to the four great hypocrisies. We have superseded Congress to facilitate $750 billion in domestic cuts, including Medicare, in order to end an artificially induced political hostage crisis over debt originating from the bills run up by a Republican president who funneled billions of taxpayer dollars to the military-industrial complex by unfunded, unnecessary, and unproductive wars, enabled in doing so by the very same Republican leaders who now cry for balanced budgets, and we have called it compromise. And those who defend it have called it a credit to a pragmatic president who wins some sort of political points, because having stood for almost nothing here, he gave away almost nothing for which he stood. It would be comical if it were not tragic. Either way, it is a signal moment in our history in which both parties have agreed and codified that the political structure of this nation shall now be based entirely on hypocrisy and political self-perpetuation. Let us start with the first of the great hypocrisies, the committee. The Republican dogs can run back to their corporate masters and say they have forced $1.5 trillion in cuts and palmed off the responsibility for them on this nonsensical super Congress committee. For 2.5 brutal years, we have listened to these Tea Party mountebanks screech about the Constitution of the United States as if it were the revealed word and not the product of other, albeit far better, politicians. They demand the repeal of amendments they don't like and the strict interpretations of the ones they do and the specific citation of authorization within the Constitution for every proposed act or expenditure or legislation except this one. Where does it say in the Constitution that the two houses of Congress can, in effect, create a third house to do their dirty work for them, to sacrifice a few congressmen and senators so the vast majority of incumbents can tell the voters they had nothing to do with this? This leads to the second of the great hypocrisies, how in the same breath the Republicans can create an extra constitutional super Congress and yet also demand a constitutional amendment to force the economic stupidity that would be a mandated balanced budget. Firstly, pick a side. Ignore the Constitution or adhere to it. And of what value would this mandated balanced budget be? Our own history proves that at a time of economic crisis, if the businesses aren't spending and the consumers aren't spending, the government must spend. Our ancestors were the lab rats in the horrible experiments of the Hoover administration that brought on the Great Depression, in which the government curled up into a ball while it simultaneously insisted the economy should heal itself when, in times of crisis, then and now, the economy turns out to be comprised entirely of a bunch of rich people who will sit on their money no matter if the country starves. Forgotten in the Republican voodoo dance, dressed in the skins of the mythical balanced budget, triumphant over the severed head of short-term retrenchment that they can hold up to their moronic followers, are the long-term implications of the mandated balanced budget. What happens if there's ever another war or another terrorist attack or another natural disaster or any other emergency that requires a government to spend $1 more than it has? A constitutional amendment denying us the right to run a deficit is madness, and it will be tested by catastrophe sooner than any of its authors with their underdeveloped imaginations that can count only contributions and votes can contemplate. And the third of the great hypocrisies is hidden inside the shell game that is this super Congress. The super Congress is supposed to cut evenly from domestic and defense spending. But if it cannot agree on those cuts, or Congress will not endorse them, there will be a trigger that automatically cuts $1.2 trillion or more. But those cuts will not necessarily come evenly from the Pentagon. We are presented with an agreement that seems to guarantee the gutting of every local sacred cow from the Defense Department, except if the congressmen and senators to whom the cows are sacred disagree and overrule or sabotage the Super Congress, or except if for some reason a 12-member committee split evenly along party lines can't manage to avoid finishing every damned vote 6-6. We're cutting defense, unless we're not. The fourth of great hypocrisies is the evident agreement to not add any revenues to the process of cutting. Not only is the impetus to make human budget sacrifices out of the poor and dependent formalized, but the rich and the corporations are thus indemnified again and given more money not merely to spend on themselves and their own luxuries, but more vitally, they are given more money to spend on buying politicians, buying legislatures, buying courts, buying entire states, all of which can be directed like so many weapons in the service of one cause and one cause alone, making by statute and ruling the further protection of the wealthy at the expense of everybody else untouchable, inviolable, permanent. The White House today boasted of loopholes to be closed and tax breaks to be rescinded later by a committee that is yet to be formed. There are no new taxes except the stealth ones enacted on 99 out of 100 Americans by this evil transaction. Every dollar cut from the safety net is another dollar added to the citizens' cost for education, for security, for health, for life itself. It is another dollar he can't spend on making a better life for himself, or at least his children. It is another dollar he must spend instead on simply keeping himself alive. Where is the outrage over these great hypocrisies? Do you expect it to come from a corrupt and corrupted media for whom access is of greater importance than criticizing the failure of a political party or defending those who don't buy newspapers or can't leap website paywalls or could not afford cable TV? Do you expect it to come from a cynical and manipulative political structure? Do you expect it from those elected officials who no longer know anything of government or governance, but only proceed how to get elected or how to pose in front of a camera and pretend to be leaders? Do you expect it from politicians themselves who will merely calculate whether or not it's right based on whether or not it will get them more contributions? Do you expect it will come from the great middle ground of this country with a population obsessed with entertainment, video games, social media, sports, and trivia? Where is the outrage to come from? From you. It will do no good to wait for the politicians to suddenly atone for their sins. They're too busy trying to keep their jobs to do their jobs. It will do no good to wait for the media to suddenly remember its origins as the free press, the watchdog of democracy envisioned by Jefferson. They are too busy trying to get exclusive details about exactly how the bank robbers emptied the public's pockets to give a damn about telling anybody what they looked like or which way they went. It will do no good to wait for the apolitical public to get a clue. They can't hear the clue through all the chatter and scandal and diversion and delusion and illusion. The betrayal of what this nation is supposed to be about did not begin with this deal, and it surely will not end with this deal. There is a tide pushing back the rights of each of us, and it has been artificially induced by union bashing and the sowing of hatreds and fears, and now this ever more institutionalized economic battering of the average American. It will continue and it will crush us, because those who created it are organized and unified and hell-bent. And the only response is to be organized and unified and hell-bent in return. We must find again the energy and the purpose of the 1960s and early 1970s, and we must protest this deal and all the goddamn deals to come in the streets. We must arise nonviolently but insistently. General strikes, boycotts, protests, sit-ins, non-cooperation, takeovers. But modern versions of that resistance, facilitated and amplified by a weapon our predecessors did not have, the glory that is instantaneous communication. It is from an old and almost cliched motion picture that the wisdom comes. First, you've got to get mad. I cannot say to you, meet here or there at this hour or that one, and we'll peacefully break the back of government that now exists merely to get its functionaries reelected. But I can say that the time is coming when the window for us to restore the control of our government to ourselves will close, and we had damn well better act before then. Because this deal is more than a tipping point in which the government goes from defending the safety net to gutting it. This is wrong. And while our government has now declared that it has given up the concept of right and wrong, you and I have not and will not do so.
Welcome, Keith Oakman, to the progressive movement in America. Nice to see that you're giving in your good Democrat liberal card for progressive. Let's get the job done. Go to the streets. Raise hell. Movement that is alive and vibrant and well. We welcome you. I'm Gary Noll, your chance to speak back, 888-874-4888. While you're getting ready to call in now, my guests will be coming up in about 4 minutes. Let's say hello to Elizabeth in studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Gary. We have an announcement here. We'd really love it if we could have two volunteers, please. The first is to help with production assistant. Today, anywhere from around sort of late afternoon, 5:30 to about 10, Also, a driver to go from around 56th sort of area.
No, it'll be from up here. We have to take our crew downtown.
Okay.
But we need two drivers, and we need a couple extra people because we're doing a split filming today. Half our crew is upstate. I'm going to take the ones down to David Boulay. We're filming him teaching tonight, which will be very exciting for anyone who volunteers. And we have a big shoot. It's a four-camera shoot in his cooking school. That's from 6 to 9, and we have to be there at 5 to set up. So someone who could come at 4 would be helpful.
Okay.
And the number on that?
It's please call Paola, and her number is 646-926-5439. 646-926-5439. Thank you.
I'm going to hold your thoughts till tomorrow, because I want to say hello to a few people on the air, including Ryan. Ryan from New York City. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Gary. How are you today?
Doing great, thank you.
I just wanted to add some perspective to some of the comments earlier.
Yes, please do.
I agree with most of everything that you said, but I would like to point out a couple of important facts pertaining to Iraq.
Sure.
The last election in Iraq had a higher percentage voter turnout than the last U.S. election had, percentage to the population, and I think that that is a good sign. My father was in the Korean War. That was also considered unnecessary. Nobody wanted to go after World War II. Nobody wanted to go. Today, Korea, thank God we went, is a successful democracy, one of the richest countries in the world. And I think that there are, Bush will be seen differently in the future. A lot of mistakes were made. Cheney was a disaster. Well, especially Rumsfeld, he was a disaster. But overall, when you look at what happened to us, the fact that Bush created a democracy in Iraq that is working now, it's actually starting to work. And I know it's not popular on the left to point that out, but I think it's only fair to point it out.
Okay, well, Ryan, first of all, we're not right and we're not left. We're independent. We look at issues for what they are. I don't have time today to discuss why I believe that we did not bring democracy to Iraq, that we now have 4 million refugees, Iraqis who are refugees, that 1,100,000 Iraqi men, women, and children have died, that we've polluted the entire country with depleted uranium forever, that they don't have more than an hour a day, if they're lucky, of electricity, that childhood diseases and childhood mortality are the highest of any of the Middle Eastern countries that are considered developed, that also that Bush lied, Cheney lied, they all lied, they lied together and they knew it was lies, but none have been held accountable, as should be when you lie and you cause this, that there's no George Bush going into the hospitals for the 6,000 who, I should say over 33,000 who were injured, and being there to help them get back on their feet. He made a few appearances, photo appearances, and what can he do to the 6,000 that have now died? And the $3 trillion that have been spent. Now, I'm not going to argue at this moment, though I do appreciate your call, Ryan, that we have 17 million children in the United States who go to school hungry each day because their families cannot afford to feed them. We have senior citizens eating cat food because they cannot afford the regular food. We have 20 million Americans couch surfing, throwing out of their house, in no small measure all because of George Bush. And if you want to look at if we brought democracy, you're absolutely right that more people went out to that election than ever before. But understand that those are people who want desperately to have some peace in their country. They want us removed. We're not going to be out of their country. We're going to stay out of the largest embassy in the world. We're also going to have more than 100,000 private contractors there who are armed and really just troops, but they're paid $1,200 a day instead of $144 a day. But you change the name of a combat troop to a contractor, and it suddenly sanitizes it. And there's an enormous amount of sectarian violence. Yeah, you don't have a lot of killing in certain neighborhoods because everyone who could be killed, who was not of the same ethnic background, has already been cleansed. So ethnic cleansing has been pretty perfect in some areas. And then you have giant walls 20 foot high that separate people. And corruption is endemic at every level. Otherwise, I guess we could say, yeah, Bush brought democracy to Iraq. Thank you very much. We're going to get our guest up on the phone, but before, let's say hello to Tim from Jersey. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Gary.
What can we help you with today, Tim? You'd like to share a thought, please?
Yes, sir. It is my opinion that what we need is a progressive, independent individual with a vice president partner in that White House this next election.
I agree, but that won't happen. No, it won't.
And can we possibly do it?
No,
is
it's,
there any way in
no,
the world?
No, it is not humanly possible. Let us look pragmatically at what we can do. Mm-hmm. Right now, there are more people seeking information on progressive radio than Democrat and Republican radio combined. The difference is we're looking for solutions that are inclusive, not that exclude left or right, conservative or liberal. We believe in including people. So as a result, there are more people who are weaning themselves off the hardline ideologies and looking for peace, harmony, health, and happiness.
They're moving away from the official reports.
The official sanctuaries. That will take at least another 2 to 3 years to have organized and have these people brought together to form alliances on themes we can all agree upon, to get a constitutionalist and a libertarian and a Liberty Party person and a progressive conservative and liberal to all agree. Can't we at least agree that we should help our children? I think all would say yes. Can't we agree that we need to save our public health from having incursions on the public commons? I think most would say yes. Shouldn't we regain our since constitutional requirements of habeas corpus? Most would say yes. So we have to focus upon where we can be in agreement. That creates alliances. From that could create a movement forward. And that's what we're lacking, but we will get there. There are millions upon millions upon millions of those of us who want to see a better world without having it monikered as left or right, conservative or liberal. Instead, let's just take out the isms and just put the notion we are all human beings who deserve to live in harmony, happiness, and health. And we can do that if we have people who are interested in our well-being instead of their own or those who bought their way into office. It'll take some time. Please be patient. And the worse things get, the more people will be forced out of those landlocked positions that they have been reticent to look at. 85% of all the information a person who is indoctrinated receives, they immediately exclude. That's 85%. That's why you can have arguments and debates on issues. But if you're a true believer in something, you're not going to even want to hear what someone else has to say. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. Let's now go over and say hello to Dr. Deborah Davis. She's standing by. I gave you her background earlier. Nice to have you with us again.
Very nice to be with you.
I assume you're on Skype?
I certainly am.
Okay. I'm going to just ask if you would please to speak up. I'm going to ask you just two basic questions and turn it over to you. We have been led to believe by all of our official institutions and their representatives, including the media, over the past 15 years, that electromagnetic equipment, cell phones, were harmless. There was no good science. That anyone claiming otherwise was simply an alarmist, wanting to scare us, and therefore should not be held responsible. Therefore, when the studies started coming in, all the studies from human studies and rat studies, we as a public tended to reject these because we had been given assurances from our official leaders and official institutions and official media and our doctors that there was no health risks. Now tell us the story we did not know, chose not to listen to, and what it means for our health in the future, since we've already been exposed, we've already drank the poison. Can we then simply accept that, okay, I just won't use my cell phone enough, but whatever I've done in the past won't matter? The form is yours.
Let me thank you so much, Gary, for your interest in this issue. I also couldn't believe cell phone would be a problem when I started out looking into this 6-7 years ago. At that time, I owned 3 phones. But I learned, much to my shock, that the United States is far behind other nations in its understanding of the science, that we do not have a significant research program underway at all to monitor human health impact. And I was stunned to find this out, and then I learned and wrote about it in my book, Disconnect, that the cell phone industry had basically taken a playbook out of the tobacco industry and had used science as a form of public relations. In fact, as you understand, science is inherently complex, and there always is uncertainty when it comes to science. And the public has come away understandably confused, because if you can create doubt in the minds of people about whether or not there's a problem, you've already won. There was a famous memo written by the Lorillard Tobacco Company, doubt is our product. If you can sell doubt to people, then they'll continue doing what they're doing. And that is basically what's happened. But that ended. It ended last year when a number of things happened, when a U.S. Senate hearing was held with standing room only, featuring experts from Finland, in Israel, who spoke of what their nations have been doing on cell phones, and you can find information on that on our website at ehtrust.org. And I also testified talking about what the science shows. Let's talk for a second about that. The risk of brain cancer, fortunately, is relatively rare. But if you've got brain cancer, your risk, obviously, is 100%. The risk is approximately 6 per 100,000 in the U.S. population overall. That's relatively rare compared to things like lung, colon, and breast cancer, which are much more common. If that risk quadruples, it will go from 6 per 100,000 to 24 per 100,000. So the risk to the population is still relatively rare. But, and here's the kicker, we never had 100% of people smoking cigarettes. We never had 100% of people exposed to asbestos. Those risks were quite large, and as a consequence, we now are recovering from epidemics of smoking-related cancer. For cell phones, the relative risk may be not that great for an individual, but it's huge for the population. And because we have everybody, including hundreds of millions of children in this country and around the world, using cell phones today, the population risk is huge. The same thing holds for air pollution, as an example. The relative risk of developing lung cancer or bronchitis from being exposed to air pollution is not that great overall. But for the population, it involves 30,000 to 60,000 deaths a year that could be avoided. We don't have those numbers yet for cell phones, and if we are smart, we won't wait to get them. Up till now, up till your show and others, the focus has always been on brain cancer. Do cell phones increase the risk of brain cancer, yes or no? In my opinion, the answer is yes. But I also believe that the question of brain cancer is the wrong question. Let me explain. A cell phone is a two-way microwave radio. It works by sending a signal from the phone to the tower. When you answer the phone, the moment you answer it, the signal jumps up in strength just for less than a second. So that's when you want to never have a phone next to your head. And when the phone is transmitting to the tower, which it does regularly, whether you're talking on it or whether it's in your pocket, about half of the radiation from the phone gets into your body. That's clearly established by industry's own studies. So when you're using a cell phone, whether you're talking on it or just simply holding it next to your body, it is actively sending radiation, microwave radiation, to the tower. The amount of microwave radiation in a cell phone is very, very weak. It is too weak on its own to directly break the bonds that hold chemicals together. It's called non-ionizing radiation. But although it's weak, the pulsed digital nature of the signal may be why the cell phone signal can be so disruptive and is shown in experimental studies to damage DNA. Recently, the Environmental Health Trust, the group that I set up, co-chaired a meeting with distinguished scientists in Turkey and Greece that was held in Istanbul, which can be found on our website at saferphonezone.com. And that Istanbul conference featured a number of important peer-reviewed studies that found that taking pregnant rabbits and rats, exposing them to cell phone radiation for 1 hour a day for 21 days, resulted in offspring with fewer brain cells, had less brain cells than unexposed baby rats and rabbits, and more damage to their brains, their livers, and their eyes. So we now know that this issue is much bigger than brain cancer, and that the brain cancer story has been vastly overblown. And as you know from other things that you've done over the years, no matter how much damage you may have had to your DNA from cell phone radiation, you can start right now, get the phone out of your pocket, certainly not in your breast pocket or your pants pocket, and start to do the things that you've been promoting that many people, including scientists working with National Cancer Institute, advise, which is diets that are high in fresh fruits and vegetables, full of antioxidants, as well as other techniques that have been shown to improve people's survival and prevention of cancer. DNA damage happens all the time. How our bodies deal with it depends on what else we do with them, whether we eat our broccoli, whether we sleep in the dark, whether we exercise regularly, whether we pray or meditate. All of those things affect the chance that we will get cancer or that we can fix damage that may have occurred.
I appreciate your insights to us. It's important that we understand that the industry will actually use the science, even the bad science, as the tobacco industry did, to its advantage by not being able to show an epidemic in statistics at this moment. But what they're not recognizing, which your group has, and the studies show, is that when DNA is damaged, it's not just DNA in the brain, it can be DNA in other parts of the body, then look at everything else that we're doing that could be damaging DNA. And then when you add all that together, then you have to say this is just one more piece of damaging the DNA, and therefore, why do anything intentionally that can damage DNA when you can prevent that by being reasonable? You can put the you can put your cell phone on speaker and hold it away from your body. You can use one of those blue tubes. You don't have to hold it up to your ear, as people think, and you certainly shouldn't be using it as much as we currently use it. And if you're riding in a car, don't leave it in your pocket. Put it in the seat beside you. There are some things we can do that are not high-tech and that are not that difficult, as well as taking our antioxidants and eating a healthier diet, which provides the phytonutrients. Many of those phytonutrients are proven by multiple studies to impact DNA in a positive way. So we can undo a lot of damage as long as we understand that the damage is not solely and exclusively to the brain. Your final thoughts, please.
I think you're absolutely right on that point, Gary. The damage is certainly not just to the brain. In fact, studies have found that men who keep cell phones in their pockets or use them for 4 hours a day have about half the sperm count of others. And that reduction in sperm count, people joke, well, that's a form of birth control. Well, let me tell you, it's not. You need almost 500 million healthy sperm to make one healthy child. You know, they say the reason you need so many is that sperm do not know how to ask for directions. But reality is you need healthy sperm, and a lot of them. Studies that have been done in 4 different national laboratories in Australia, in Turkey, in Greece, and at the Cleveland Clinic by one of the most distinguished researchers in the world on this subject, Professor Ashok Agarwal, have shown clear evidence of damage to DNA, and detailed laboratory studies have found the damage occurs in the mitochondria in the tail of the sperm, and the mitochondria really are the engine of cells. So if your sperm is unhealthy, it can't swim as far or as fast, it's misshapen, you've got a big problem.
We also have the possibility that some of the sperm would be damaged, and therefore if conception should occur, you may be setting the progenitor for some form of birth defect or miscarriage that would happen because the sperm was not healthy. We've seen this with people who consume a lot of alcohol or in high-risk environmental toxic places, that this also can affect sperm. So I'm very concerned that we should not let this go lightly. I want to thank you very much for coming on and sharing your insights. And more of this is in the book, Disconnect, The Truth About Cell Phone Radiation and What the Industry Has Done to Hide It. Thank you very much.
Also, Gary, mentioned that you can follow us on Twitter at Safer Phones, and we have a Facebook page, the Campaign for Safer Cell Phones. We have a campaign now that reaches across the world in more than 14 nations, and there are materials you can download from our website under free resources at ehtrust.org. And I'd welcome a chance to work with you on this, because we realize people need to understand this is a serious public health threat that can, as you point out very correctly, be prevented by taking simple steps Distance is your friend. Use cell phones safely and understand that we all can do better and protect ourselves and our families. Thank you again for your interest.
Thank you, and we will be making this an ongoing issue. And a doctor or professor at Deborah Davis, who's a renowned environmental health expert, as a former professor of epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh and currently a visiting professor at Harvard and Georgetown Universities. I'm Gary Noll. That's our program today. Something on the environment, something on health, something on healing, something on human nature, and something on our body politic, allowing us to have a different perspective. Thank you very much. I look forward to sharing more on our next program, and hopefully my filming with David Boulay will go great tonight, because sooner or later you're going to have a chance to see this America's Greatest Chef. He's a really interesting person, and the wisdom that he brings with his recipes.